Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Karen Becker as my special expert guest. Dr. Karen Becker is a proactive and integrative wellness veterinarian. She studied wildlife and international resource management at the University of Wisconsin and earned her degree as a veterinarian at Iowa State School of Veterinarian Medicine. Dr. Becker also has a strong educational background in acupuncture and homeopathy for pets and animals. Today, Karen helps thousands of patients achieve wellness through her natural pet animal hospital, Feathers Bird Clinic, and Therapaw Rehabilitation and Pain Management Clinic in Illinois. Dr. Becker and her husband founded the Covenant Wildlife Rehab Center in 2002, which is dedicated to caring for injured and orphaned wild animals. Dr. Becker is also the veterinary consultant for Mecola Healthy Pets, the largest pet wellness website on the internet. She speaks at public seminars, has appeared on The Animal Planet, and was named one of Chicago's top 10 vets by Chicago Magazine. Good morning, Karen, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have someone with your expertise and insight. You can learn a lot about human nutrition, human function, and health by studying animals. So what is it about animals that attracts you to them? You could have gone into a different type of medicine working with people, humans, as opposed to animals. So what is it about animals that connects you to them and motivates you to put so much time and energy into their care and welfare?
Well, I think most people, there's an attraction between people and the animal kingdom. Certainly, I'm the same way. I have a deep attraction to the animal kingdom. I love people, but working with animals just fulfills in me something that working with people exclusively would not, in terms of my desire to care for all of the species on the planet. So it's interesting. Through being a veterinarian, you end up caring for the other end of the leash. So my primary focus is on the patient, but attached to every patient, there is a client. So you do end up having some interaction, of course, with caring for family. You end up doing family medicine in some regard, but in general, I'm enamored with life, and because life is amazing, I'm a perpetual learner, and I think that a lot of learners become students, and students become teachers, and I'm pretty passionate about teaching what I have learned to others about how to be better caretakers for the animals that they're caring for. So it was a natural course for me to become a veterinarian. I started caring for animals very early in my life, and it just was very logical. I never thought about doing anything else. It was a logical progression for me.
In your research and studies, have you had a chance to look at the history of the connection between humans and pets? I know that animals have not always been pets, and that is kind of new on the evolutionary time scale. When did we start having pets, and has it evolved into something that is out of control or become too extreme in some cases? What is your take on this apparent need in people to have an animal in their home and look after it?
I think originally, of course, people's interactions with animals were utilitarian. Animals served a function. So we know that the earliest documented interaction between a person and what we would call a domesticated pet was that of a kitten. A kitten skeleton was found buried in Egypt with a skeleton of human remains, which means they're probably, because it was an intentional burial of the animal with the person, that there was a bond there between the two of them. So we know that animals have coexisted with people for quite some time. So whether that's wolves scavenging at garbage dumps outside of primitive people's compounds, or whether that was the Egyptians that we believe domesticated cats to guard their granary. So we know that cats' evolutionary diet has no grain in it, so they don't have a requirement for starch or carbohydrate. So kitties being obligate carnivores, they really were the perfect of the small cats. Cats are a member of the Felis catus, that's their genus and species, which is a small group of seven cats that are all obligate carnivores. And Felis catus seemed like a nice choice for those Egyptians to domesticate because they served a purpose. So the cats were able to be well fed by consuming the mice that they were guarding. The kitties were introduced there to protect the grains that the Egyptians raised, sowed, and harvested. So there was this kind of co-communal relationship. And out of that, I would assume that those native peoples figured out how cool cats were, they ended up worshiping them as a society. They found them so cool. So from that point, I think certainly in the U.S., farmers enjoyed interaction with dogs. 200 years ago, dogs lived outside. But then, as I think time would naturally have it, we end up on cold evenings 100 years ago bringing the dog into the back porch because it was just too cold to leave him outside. And then probably the farmer's wife decided that maybe he was really nice to have in on nights and weekends. And then slowly over the course of the last 200 years, dogs and cats both have migrated from outdoors and a co-communal enjoyment relationship outside to inside our homes and a lot of times right into our bed. So you bring up a really good point. Are pets kind of replacing, in some instances, children for a lot of folks that intentionally choose animals over kids? But I also think that animals, for a lot of people, myself included, they fulfill a part of me that people just can't. You know, animals are unconditional, and they don't really care what you look like, and they never say a cross bad thing about you, and they don't gossip, and they're there for you no matter what. They just are. They're really a constant beacon of positive, good energy, regardless of the kind of day you had, and they're really consistent in their personality. So I think we're drawn to animals because of that, and I think a lot of people find solace and peacefulness in having a lifelong relationship with a pet. It doesn't mean that that should replace a human companion, but we certainly have recognized that pets can, and animals in general, nature can fulfill a part of our souls that need filled that can't necessarily be filled by people. So I think that that's something that if you've had a pet or if you enjoy animals that you probably have experienced.
Yes, I've certainly met people that prefer their pets over people. And I kind of understand why. Do you think that a dog or a cat is capable of actually loving us? Because I've had disagreements and arguments with pet owners. They actually believe that their pets love them exactly the same way that humans love each other. Now, do we misperceive what the dog, like, I know they have facial recognition technology in their brains, and they can wag their tail, and they tend to respond to rewards. Do you think that pets actually love us, or do we misperceive that because we want to be loved so much by them?
Well, and of course, there's no way to know. We can anthropomorphize. We can guess as to what other animals are feeling. We do know that, you know, they can experience joy, rage, frustration, anger, and jealousy. So by default, love, it's impossible to know if they would love us in the same capacity, probably not. They're two different species, but the three different species, if we include kitties in the mix, we're three entirely different animals. But do I think that there can be a united feeling of gratitude and an enjoyment of wanting to be around one another, potentially more so than other species? Sure. And I think that that can be universally found regardless of what species you put together.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, I think it's wonderful to understand the history and the connection and to see things as they truly are as opposed to wanting them to be something different. You mentioned something about the original diet, which excluded the consumption of grains. I'm kind of like that myself when it comes to promoting a diet for humans that is more paleo, less grain dominant, less sugar dominant. Of course, you know all about this, but isn't there a relationship that's kind of the same today with the insulin sensitivity and the insulin resistance that we see in humans and all these carbs and gluten insensitivity? Isn't there sort of a connection that's kind of the same in
sure.
dogs and cats?
Of course. In the last 100 years, we've seen the same decline. I'll just give you a little bit of background about the pet food industry. The first quote-unquote dog and cat foods that entered the market really entered less than 100 years ago. So this whole premise of feeding dog and cat food is kind of funny to me. It's kind of like saying that you feed people food to your kid. This whole idea of feeding something out of a can all day, every day for three meals from the time your pet is born till the time that they die, it's kind of an absurd thought. And yet veterinarians have successfully convinced pet owners to feed a little crunchy kibble, and we've convinced you that it contains every nutrient, fatty acid, enzyme, omega that's totally required. Never switch the food and feed it to your pet, and it will promote and sustain unbelievable health for every day of your pet's life. It's a total absurdity to think we could get that out of an overprocessed, inorganic, carbohydrate-based dead food. And yet the veterinary industry, we have successfully convinced pet owners that they should just be feeding dog food or cat food to pets. And So the first dog and cat food entered the market about 100 years ago, and unfortunately, the pet food industry has become a place where rendered human food, which means foods that don't make the mark for USDA food inspectors, are passed on then to the animal food market. So pet food companies buy rendered means not approved for human consumption. Pet food companies buy rendered grains, so moldy grains that contain aflatoxins or mycotoxins, and then we combine that with rendered proteins. Rendered proteins are dead, dying, diseased animals or carcasses that have been previously, animals that have previously died, are ground up to create what's called crude protein. And then those protein sources are blended with the rendered grains, and we add a synthetic multivitamin mineral supplement. We extrude it at 400 degrees, and then we call it pet food and sell it to you for really, really high prices and tell you it will create a thriving body over a lifetime. It's a fallacy, of course, no more than us telling you that you can get unbelievable nourishment through the dollar menu and you can feed your kids 3 times a day for $3 and your kids are going to grow up to be strong and healthy. It's just untrue. And the difference is we have really educated people that understand these health and wellness principles for themselves, but they're unable to make that translation to their pets, which is a pretty interesting concept. But one of the things I'm passionate about is helping people make the connection and connect the dots between healthy, whole, species-appropriate, organic whole foods and nutrients that you'd be able to pass along to your dogs and cats and those that are created synthetically in mass-produced warehouses and pet food companies' facilities that are making a tremendous amount of profit off of a very poor quality food. So that's one of absolutely my passions, is helping people understand that carbohydrates are unnecessary for dogs and cats. Cats are obligate carnivores. They have to have a meat-based diet. So cats were really evolved to eat mice, and dogs evolved to eat rabbits. Now, dogs are called scavenging carnivores, which means they have not nearly the high food standards that cats do. Dogs will catch and kill rabbits, but they'll also eat dead rabbits. They'll eat rabbit pieces and parts. They'll eat rabbit poo. They'll eat grass. They'll eat berries. Dogs will eat a little bit of everything in their environment. They would prefer to eat fresh raw meat, but they will eat dead rancid meat and poo and a whole host of other things. Cats are pretty strict with their dietary requirements. So unfortunately, in the last 100 years, with the evolution of these carbohydrate processed diets, not only has the obesity issue gone hog wild with dogs and cats, where the obesity issue in our pets is about the same percentage, 2 out of 3 pets are obese, about the same as people, but we also have to, of course, have the same cortisol issues, we have the same insulin resistance issues, we have the same diabetes issues, and of course, we have a growing cancer problem, all fed because of the carbohydrate issue. So it's most certainly present in veterinary medicine as it is in human medicine.
The parallels are almost infinite between humans and animals. I was just thinking about the need for exercise and movement and training in an animal, which is also complete in the human example, as well as the nutrition. We promote a concept of whole, natural, genomically clean food that one finds individually unique to ourselves, and then to move as a function of necessity based on our design. Is that also true with animals? Do we also need to have the same approach of being selective and individualizing them as an individual in the same way that we ourselves need to do that?
You bet. And what's really important, and a lot of people assume, you know, I have an indoor house cat, he doesn't need to exercise. Or a lot of people assume, you know, that they have these little tiny fashion dogs that they carry around everywhere. A lot of people assume that if their dog is under 20 pounds, that it gets enough exercise just walking around the house. And of course, you and I know that that's simply not true, that animals, dogs and cats, are wired as amazing athletes, and they need heart-thumping, rigorous, amazing, at least at minimum of 20 minutes, preferably 40 minutes of nonstop cardio a day, not only for metabolic health, but for mental health. And so we have a huge problem with pets being bored and boredom-based behaviors. The number one reason pets are dumped at the Humane Society is because of behavior problems, and many of those behavior problems can be linked to lack of exercise. So we have the same issues happening in our pets that as we do in, with people, which is sad, and most importantly, totally preventable.
What do you think about the psychology of pet profiling? A person that I know is engaged in helping people select the right kind of pet with the right type of psychology and mindset that, I guess, meets their expectations. Or maybe I should ask this question. If I'm thinking about getting a cat or a dog, what should I start out with first before I even get the dog? Should I think about the profile of the animal, or what are the steps that you consider to be ideal when thinking about getting a pet for maybe your children or for maybe your mother who's single or whatever?
Well, first of all, I would never recommend, unless the person is physically incapable of getting it themselves, I never recommend pets as gifts ever, unless the person has specifically asked you to please help them find an animal. So number one, you're going to evaluate your own lifestyle. Can you physically walk? Are you capable of running a dog? If you live in a one-bedroom apartment in a downtown big city and you can't physically walk, we would not recommend you get a border collie that requires, 5.5 miles of a good run every day for mental health. That would be a poor fit. Likewise, if you're an athletic person that is gone all the time, that's never home, you may be interested in a border collie, but because you travel 80 hours a week and you're gone, maybe an indoor house cat would be more your speed. So first, it's important that you evaluate your lifestyle to know that you have the time, energy, commitment, and finances to be able to commit to a pet for a lifetime, which means on average, depending on what you're getting, anywhere between 10 and 20 years, depending on what species you decide on. So I do believe that going with a pet life coach or having someone, especially if this is your first time pet owner, having someone help you pick the right breed. And then even within the right breed, there are many, many mutts, and there are a lot of mixed breeds that are fabulous pets and older animals waiting to be adopted at local shelters. But still, there needs to be personality checks. It's a lot like when you're picking out a mate for yourself, that you not just base it on the physical characteristic that you're interested in. So I have a lot of clients say, I just really want a German Shepherd. I really like how a German Shepherd looks. You might like how a German Shepherd looks, but you might not like how much they bark or how much they shed or some of the genetic flaws that could come along lurking in the DNA of the German Shepherd that you're interested in. So I do think it's important to evaluate your lifestyle, evaluate the animal that you think you're interested in, and then last but certainly not least, is even within breed or size, color characteristics, temperament, longevity, all of the things you're interested in, you absolutely have an individual personality involved. You can get a crabby miniature poodle. You can get a fabulous miniature poodle. You could get a shy miniature poodle. You could get a very outgoing, tenacious miniature poodle. So even within typical characteristics that breed counselors will tell you about, you've got to make sure that you're matching personalities up. So I think that there's a lot of value in doing your homework before you would ever consider getting a pet. And most importantly, we would never tell you to go to a pet store to get a pet because they come from puppy mills, and puppy mills are a pretty face but a horrific background and poor genetics. So we don't recommend supporting that.
Do animals have much in the way of rights? You talk about puppy mills, and of course, the argument is that we eat them, so therefore we should, as humans, be able to exploit them, and therefore they have no rights. In different cultures, they eat different things. I'm sure in other cultures they eat dogs. We eat pigs
right here.
In some cultures they wouldn't eat pigs. That sort of brings us to an interesting observation of a mix of different approaches or a philosophy. So when we are thinking about having a pet or choosing a pet, it's important to maybe approach it more philosophically with some careful thinking and also be prepared to make a commitment that's not going to just be for tonight, but more of a long-term commitment.
Well, of course, it's a forever relationship. So if you're a vegan, I would not recommend that you get a carnivorous animal because you will not be able to nourish that pet in a biologically appropriate fashion, which means dogs and cats have to have meat to be healthy. And if you're staunchly ethically opposed to meat, then I don't recommend you get a carnivorous animal because you getting a carnivore and then feeding it a vegan diet, you will watch that animal fail to thrive and eventually die because you were incapable of nourishing it correctly. And I feel that that's exploitation in and of itself. So I would recommend, let's say, a rabbit or a vegetarian animal for a vegan owner, like a Euromastix or an iguana, you would pick a vegetarian animal to line up with your ethics. If you have no problems eating meat and you have no problems touching meat and you have no problems ethically purchasing meat, then you would be even looking at a dog or cat. So it's interesting. I am a vegetarian. I'm a licensed meat inspector. And I tell my clients, I don't eat my patients. I have chickens as patients, and I have rabbits as patients, and I have dogs and cats. So the animals that I see, I can't consume. It just has been difficult for me to put them in my mouth after I meet them. So I don't eat them, but I do believe in a species-appropriate diet. So it is important that we nourish our animals in the way that they were designed to consume their food. So each animal has a biologic requirement for certain foods, and you need to do enough research that you have background in recognizing what your pet was designed to eat, because by nourishing it in a cellularly appropriate way, you'll be able to have that pet thrive over a lifetime versus live a life of degeneration, inflammation, and probably potential disease created by an unhealthy lifestyle, most of it stemming from diet.
Yeah, a lot of my patients, clients, and friends often assume that I'm a vegetarian because I'm a health nut. And I say, no, I'm a human omnivore and that I eat vegetarians, so don't invite me for dinner. There's quite a variety of methodologies here, like with pet raising, pet feeding, and I think what I'm getting by watching your videos and looking at your material is that you're like myself. You're trying to strengthen the resolve in people to choose whole, natural, real food where there's a biological connection to the animal, and then treat the animal with a lot of respect and love, and then you'll get a super healthy animal with less disease and pathology. Is that right?
That's correct. We're on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah, so tell us now about some of the dietary profiles that you promote that maybe conventional veterinarians don't agree with you on, or maybe you've had some opposition, or just like my conventional doctors think that all this focus on health food and vitamins is completely ridiculous and without any substantial evidence. And of course, we could argue that fact, but I know that you've got a lot of evidence to support your position. And what, maybe in a nutshell, is your position when it comes to feeding a dog or a cat?
Well, my position is that you need to feed a biologically appropriate diet. So what that means is what nature intended that animal to eat. So when it comes to dogs and cats, as we've just discussed, they're carnivores. And they were designed, we just discussed about eating rabbits and mice. So when we look at the profile of a rabbit and a mouse, that's a high moisture diet. That means rabbits and mice are about 70% water. We know that they are unprocessed, whole, and they are in perfect balance when it comes to fats, proteins, vitamins, minerals, omegas, all of those things. When we look at the traditional dry dog and cat food that we feed dogs and cats, it's very low moisture, it's high carbohydrate, and it's lower protein. And that's the exact opposite of what their evolutionary diet would dictate, whereas it would be high moisture, high protein, low to no carb. So I really advocate nourishing an animal in the way it was biologically designed to consume food. So if you're like me and you find it difficult to raise mice and rabbits to want to feed to your dogs and cats, you do the next best thing and you make their or purchase a biologically appropriate raw food diet, which means in my case, I make it myself, but you can certainly purchase. There's lots of great balanced meat-based diets that are available commercially now, and they're really starting to rival the dry pet food industry, and that's becoming a big problem. So raw foods, it's very important if you do make the food yourself, you have to follow a recipe. What I don't want any of your listeners to do is to throw some meat and veggies together and call it a balanced diet, because you can harm your pet by doing that. It is important that they get the perfect balance of omega-3s to 6s, that they get enough calcium, trace minerals. And it's very important that it's set in the correct proportions. But there are great resources available for you to either custom prepare a homemade diet for your pet that's raw, or as I mentioned, you can buy a commercially available raw food diet. Raw food is absolutely not accepted by the traditional veterinary community. Raw foods have been totally rejected as being risky, harmful, or even just downright pathologic for pets. And it's interesting to me because veterinarians' arguments are usually twofold. Number one, that they have been unproven to be healthy. And number two, that they could contain bacteria that could be harmful to your pet. Well, what your readers need to know is that if you're buying a commercially available raw food diet, half of them have been treated with HPP, which is high pressure pasteurization, which means raw meats have been hit with water to make the meat sterile. So there's really no risk of any pathogens. So all the E. coli, all the salmonella, all the listeria, anything that could be in the meat has been inactivated. And what most of your listeners probably already know is that much of the human food industry is also treated with HPP. So a lot of the meats that you're buying in the deli section of your favorite store have also been treated that way to reduce pathogen load. So one of the arguments from the traditional veterinary community is null and void. The second argument, that it has not been researched. What we know is that AFCO, the American Association of Feed Control Officials, have set forth standards of the minimum and maximum nutrient requirements for pets, and that it is important to me that if you feed a raw food diet, that it has been analyzed to be nutritionally balanced for pets. And all of the raw foods that you would be able to find at your upscale dog and cat boutique in your town or online have been AFCO approved. So there really isn't an argument that's logical coming from the veterinary community that can't be dispelled with a little bit of research and some good common sense. But what the bigger issue is that the dry and canned dog and cat food dollars that are being generated are starting to be impacted by people using their brains and recognizing that they can't sustain wholly sufficient, healthful life for their pets feeding a dead, inorganic, overprocessed diet. So there's quite a big shift in not only thinking, but in the numbers and revenue and dog and cat food industry is being impacted by the raw food industry, and that's causing quite a bit of uproar. So I am getting, of course, a lot of traditional veterinarians saying, what are you doing recommending this raw food for dogs and cats? You know, we didn't learn about it in vet school. And one of the things that's important for your listeners to note is that the vet schools in the United States that are nutrition classes are primarily taught by corporations, dog and cat food companies that come in to teach the nutrition classes. So it's, think of it as if you went to medical school, your pharmacology class would be taught by Bayer or by Pfizer or by a drug company. It's not the most balanced sense of nutrition. And so Science Diet, Eukanuba, Purina will come in and teach classes to veterinarians about veterinary nutrition. And that's not necessarily a balanced nutritional perspective, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, perfect sense. You know, again, it's so similar to what we experience ourselves, you know, how medical schools are compromised by big pharma, and medical students are learning information that's biased, and they're prevented from exposure to the right insight that's more sound and scientific, and they're led to believe that the other side or the other camp is non-scientific and so on, and so it just grows
that way. That's wrong, right. Yep.
So I guess there's two camps that have evolved, and you just look at two camps, you choose one or the other, and I guess it's more of your own profile or consciousness. One would be drawn towards the natural integrative versus the more commercial mainstream.
You bring up a really valuable point. What I tell my clients is, listen, you need to align yourself with a veterinarian and a thought process about feeding and nourishing your pet, and not just food, but the vaccine issue. There's a whole host of issues in veterinary medicine that, as pet owners, I believe it is your job to be empowered with knowledge enough to be able to make really wise decisions for your pets. And the concern is that if you're getting a pet and trusting your veterinarian, that's no different than you going to the medical doctor and him or her being in charge of your body and you not knowing enough to care for your own, to be an advocate for your own health. And that's a scary thing, that we should never advocate the well-being of our bodies or our pets' bodies to anyone but us, and ultimately we are our pets' guardians. It is our responsibility to know enough to make really good decisions. So that comes down to you educating yourself, and if you believe that the food that you've been feeding is doing fine and you have no problems ethically and your pet's a vision of health and lives to be 21 with no medical problems, cool. But if your pet has suffered from cancer, degenerative joint disease, autoimmune disease, organ failure, dental disease, allergies, obesity, diabetes, those are all lifestyle-related issues that are related to food, that are related to the chemicals that we put on our pets, that are related to the pesticides and herbicides we tell you to feed them or put on them topically every month to prevent fleas and ticks. Those are big concepts that should be discussed with your veterinarian that most traditional veterinarians don't want to discuss with you. They're going to roll their eyes and say, I'm the doctor, you're not a veterinarian, I've been doing this 30 years and you shouldn't question me. And then you hit the nail on the head. Then it comes down to you either recognizing, I need to find a different veterinarian that is more proactive, or I'm fine staying with this. But I think what happens is, as we evolve and learn, it's impossible to remain with a stagnant physician or a stagnant veterinarian. You end up having to find a different veterinarian that more aligns to a proactive wellness profile rather than a reactive illness profile. That can be hard to do, but you probably are quite used to empowering people to do that, even for their own health and wellness choices. Move along, find a new doctor.
Absolutely. Well, those are some powerful words. Now, what about the pet sickness industry? That must be gigantic. Have you got a figure or a number?
Those numbers are out there. I don't have one. I should have one to quote for you.
Must be in the billions, though, huh?
Yeah, and I would absolutely say in the billions. And but what I will tell you is this. I lecture every year for the graduating class of a veterinary school in the Midwest. In 2002, the dean had me down, as I was doing every year for the graduating class. I was not invited back in 2003 because in 2002, I stood up and I explained that I am a proactive veterinarian. That means as a proactive vet, my goal is to identify and remove lifestyle obstacles before disease occurs. And you could see that the senior graduating vets, you could see their eyes just glaze over like, what the heck is she talking about? And I went on to say, you know, you were trained reactively, which is the last 4 years of your veterinary education combined with the first 4 years of your undergrad education. You've had 8 years of being taught that you need to wait until disease occurs and then you need to treat the symptoms. And I'm here to tell you that you can practice entirely differently. You didn't learn anything about it in vet school, but I'm here to tell you that you can actually learn to identify and remove lifestyle obstacles before disease can occur. And the dean stood up from the back row and he said, you know, Dr. Becker, are you insinuating that if you create health, that dogs and cats will be above the level of disease? And I said, I am. And he said, well, Dr. Becker, that's about the worst business model I've ever heard of, because you're going to work yourself right out of a job and Dr. Becker will be broken. I highly recommend that no one follow her protocol. And I could feel the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I was in the middle of a huge lecture hall and I was not going to pick a fight with the dean. But what that highlighted to me was that we are absolutely teaching a disease model, not only to veterinarians, but to medical students, and that the concept of teaching young MDs and young vets how to be proactive doctors that can intentionally create wellness versus just avoid disease. We have a paradigm shift that is occurring, but it's not occurring in the schools yet. So it's a frustration, and it's something that I think it's coming, but it's coming in the human realm first. The veterinary schools are 15 to 20 years behind human medical schools. So veterinary schools are still teaching the disease paradigm, which is, on average, we're hoping that you bring your dog or cat to the vet 8 times a year, because that's generating serious cash. So you have an itchy dog, and you bring your dog in, and your vet gives your dog a steroid shot. These are not the anabolics. These are catabolic steroids, like prednisone. It doesn't do a darn thing to the immune system. It doesn't address the underlying reason that the immune system is overreactive. So your vet gives the dog an injection of prednisone, which temporarily suppresses the immune system, but prednisone is also the world's best anti-inflammatory. So for 30 days, the inflammation in the skin is temporarily reduced. We call it a Band-Aid. There's been no long-term disease change. There's been no lifestyle protocol change. There's been no addressing of the root disease. So in 30 days, we have a built-in automatic recheck. You're going to bring your dog back, because not only do we not treat the root cause, by delaying treatment, your dog has probably gotten worse. So in 30 days, you're going to call and say, you know what, it worked great for a month, but it's not working anymore. We'll come back and make another appointment. So I was taught in vet school that not only was this normal, that's how we generate revenue, is based off of one visit after another of just slapping a Band-Aid on there. Well, I am the world's most impatient veterinarian. So after about 2 or 3 of those visits, I would, as a client, I'd be saying, listen, Jack, what the heck's going on? Nothing's getting better. But I don't know if I'm just wildly impatient. I tell my clients right up front, listen, I will get to the root of this problem, and if your pet isn't better by the second visit, I will radically change my approach. And that's what integrative veterinarians do. We recognize that there's no one way for the body to heal. So we have a comprehensive approach, starting with the least toxic options, homeopathy, acupuncture, nutraceuticals, Western herbs, Eastern herbs, Ayurvedic herbs. We use all these different resources to help unlock the body's healing potential. And we'll blend whatever protocol it takes to help get that process started. But I learned that not in vet school. I learned that after vet school. So that's a proactive approach. So we're looking at genetics, nutrition, prior illnesses, environmental stressors, the pet's unique disease pattern. We're looking at all sorts of things that I was never taught in vet school to evaluate. Because I was taught in vet school, slap a Band-Aid on it because you'll create another visit and another $65 in a month. Those are two totally different viewpoints at how to address medicine. But if you're wise enough and if you're frustrated enough, you will eventually end up evolving, because you can't stand to see your pet miserable, or you recognize that your veterinarian is doing things 100% backwards. One of those two scenarios will probably come about.
Wow. Well, I would say for sure you are wildly passionate and totally committed. I mean, this is so refreshing, just absolutely wonderful. I think that we need more people like you on this planet, and thank you so much for the work that you have done and are doing. I know that we can get to you on your different websites. Can you tell us what those website addresses
Sure.
are, Karen?
Sure, you bet. So 3 times a week, I have a free e-newsletter. And if you hate e-newsletters, you can just, I have a huge online website that has got great articles and videos about every conceivable health topic pertaining to dogs and cats. That's www.mercolahealthypets.com. And that's probably the best way for you to find a quick resource if you want information on the latest food recalls, if you want information on aflatoxicosis and dry foods, if you're looking for kidney failure and cat issues. That's probably the best resource. I have a small animal clinic in Chicago. That address is naturalpetfamily.com. And I have a consulting business for all organic whole food pet foods at drkarenbecker.com.
Oh, that's great. Okay, we'll be sure to list those on your website reference at our institute. And just one final question about your book. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us about Real Food for Health Pets, perhaps why you wrote it and what we can expect to find in your book.
Sure. So I wrote a cookbook. Actually, the first edition came out probably 15 years ago. I wrote a pet cookbook by default because I had to. So I was telling people, listen, you're feeding your pets totally crappy food. You have to stop. I mean, we're trying to fight cancer. We're trying to fight major disease here, organ failure, and we're putting raw materials in that have no nutrient value whatsoever. You have to stop. And they're like, okay, cool, I get that. What do I do? So I was explaining over and over and over how to do a home-prepared meal that's balanced. I have the software that tells me if the food is balanced or not. And so I was customizing all these diets for pets. And finally, I just, quite frankly, I didn't have the time. So I put together a book. And we're now on the fourth edition, and it's called Dr. Becker's Real Food for Healthy Dogs and Cats. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at the Mercola website. You can buy it at a lot of the upscale pet boutiques. And what it does, it provides homemade recipes for dogs and cats. They don't have to be raw. There are some cookable options. So if feeding raw meat totally freaks you out right now, no problem. Still get your pets off of processed foods by making their food. You can cook it if you wish, but it's AFCO balance, NRC balance, and ancestral diet balance, which means it's balanced in all three arenas when it comes to being biologically appropriate, species appropriate, and nutritionally correct. So if you're interested in preparing food for your pets, you can make it every night, once a day, once a week, every 3 weeks, every 3 months, and freeze it. But it's a great way for you to get your pet off of commercially trashy food and onto foods that you are handpicking so you know the nutrient value.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Excellent. Well, our time is gone, Karen. Thanks so much for being my special guest on this edition of SNU. It's been a real treat, and I've really enjoyed listening to you. Your content is magnificent, and your ability to deliver. I'm sure that you're a fantastic speaker, and all those people that go and listen to you, and I'm going to send everybody to your site. We get a lot of questions on pets and animals and animal care, so we now have a great person that we can send everybody to. We always like to get a final parting comment from our guests, so something that maybe you can direct towards us, for those of us who love animals and want to do our best to look after them. What is maybe a parting word of advice?
A parting word of advice. How about if we go with, I have three pillars of health that I focus on in my practice, and my three pillars of health that you need to look at your pet every day and make sure that you're covering are, number one, are you feeding species-appropriate nutrition? Number two, are you creating a balanced immune system, so we don't want an underactive immune system that leads to chronic infections and cancer. We don't want an overactive immune system that leads to allergies, autoimmune disease. We want a balanced immune system that's done through minimizing vaccines. And then the third pillar of health is a resilient, strong frame and body. So we want muscle tone, resilient tendons and ligaments, proper weight, proper range of motion, but also healthy organ systems. And those are things that a proactive veterinarian that you could partner with would be able to help you identify. If you're just new into this and if you can't do it on your own, partnering with a proactive vet will help. So I guess the final parting comment would be, it would be hopefully my goal that this conversation would empower pet guardians to become better or more knowledgeable advocates for the animals in their care. And by owners making better choices for their pets, not only will they be around longer, but they'll be healthier. It will increase lifespan and longevity, but also vitality. And the more abundant living a pet can have, the more abundance is going to overflow into your life as well.
Dr. Karen Becker has been my special expert guest on this month's edition of SNU. She's a proactive and integrative wellness veterinarian, and she is the source of knowledge with animal welfare and care from the most natural and a philosophical point of view. Thank you very much, Karen. We really appreciate your contribution.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
representing lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with sports nutrition update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.